this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the real Syrian narrative. What is really happening in Aleppo? And cutting through the American mainstream misinformation and simply telling the truth. To do that, we cannot rely upon any of the journalists representing the mainstream media, nor the members of Congress, nor the White House. Instead, we are in Lebanon today, speaking on Skype with Eva Bartlett. Eva is an independent Canadian justice activist, a journalist, and a founding member of the Syrian Solidarity Movement, which advocates for a sovereign Syria against foreign intervention and regime change. Since 2008, Eva has been reporting from the war zones in Syria and Gaza. In 2008, she sailed on the third Free Gaza Movement boat from Cyprus and then spent the next 3 years writing about Israeli attacks, accompanying Palestinian medics to report on the use of white phosphorus and other war crimes. Since 2014, Eva has entered Syria 4 times to report on acts of terrorism on Syrians in different camps, including visiting Aleppo on several occasions and villages such as Nubal and others that have seen a great deal of terrorist activity, where there's been horrific bombing and massacres. Her articles appear in Global Research, Russia Today, Signs of the Time, Dissident Voice, among others. And her article, Deconstructing the NATO Narrative on Syria, is especially noteworthy. Her website, which includes all of her writings, is ingaza.wordpress.com. Nice to have you with us today, Eva.
Thanks very much, Gary. It's nice to be here.
Right now, there's a lot of attention on Aleppo, and even more so that the United States government is turning its attention toward Russia and the Syrian forces, accusing them exclusively of war crimes. No one else, just them. And this has been a highlight in the U.S. presidential campaign, especially with Hillary Clinton, who consistently blames Russia for all the world's ills. And during Sunday's debate, she blamed Russia for destroying Aleppo. This is what we are told, and unfortunately, there is no questioning, nor challenge, nor fact-checking. Nevertheless, Aleppo seems to be the site for a convergence of aggression by U.S.-supported terrorist organizations. The U.S.'s own military efforts, Russia and the Syrian army, are all involved in this effort. Now, as a result, over 1.5 million Syrians have been victimized. And it's also the site of the controversial bombing of a group known as the White Helmets, which I want to get into a little bit later in more depth. There's a lot of blame being thrown around about who's doing what, who's terrorizing whom, who is supporting who. And for the average American, Syria's a lot of confusion in our mainstream media, and the ramblings of the Obama and Samantha Power group at the UN seem intent on keeping it exactly that way. And yet, there have been bombings of hospitals, aid support, the use of chemical weapons, and much more. So please take your time. I have no other guest today because you have been there multiple times. You have seen what is happening. You have interviewed all forms of individuals. Therefore, you're in a better perspective than others to give us a clearer picture of what's actually happening on the ground. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Thank you for that introduction. I think that some of the most pressing things that need to be addressed right now, because there are so many media lies and manipulations and distortions and omissions and obfuscations on this issue, is Aleppo. There are, of course, many lies on other areas of Syria, but right now Aleppo is one of the most pressing issues, and various reasons for that. Primarily, the Syrian army is making gains in eradicating terrorist hotbeds in Aleppo, and the Western-led coalition that supposedly is fighting terrorism in Syria is doing is not doing that, to be honest. Further, we can get into this, but it's well documented that long prior to 2011. A coalition, an alliance of Western nations, Gulf nations, Israel, Turkey, NATO members, had wanted to overthrow the elected president, Bashar al-Assad. And, you know, whatever people think of President Assad, it is irrelevant, because in the end, what is happening in Syria is not about President Assad. But back in 2005, one of the measures that was implemented to enforce regime change, as they call it, in Syria was an imposition of Western sanctions on the country, which I should say have been devastating. And I think that listeners will hopefully relate to the effect of sanctions in Iraq and the million people that those led to the death of. But with regards to Syria, sanctions have been crippling the health and economy the most. But back to Aleppo. So, you know, the Western coalition is not happy with the fact that with the help, the invited help of Russia, who were invited to participate in fighting terrorism in Syria back in October 2015, with the help of Russia and other regional allies, the Syrian army has made advances and has cleaned out neighborhoods of terrorists that have plagued the neighborhoods since mid or late 2012. And having myself been to Aleppo twice, once in July and once in August this year, I can say that even since then, neighborhoods that I went past, which at the time were occupied by a variety of what most Syrians would call terrorists, because they don't call them rebels, they call them terrorists, and it, from the Free Syrian Army to Harar al-Sham to, of course, al-Nusra. These terrorists occupy certain areas of eastern Aleppo, and they at the time I was there, they occupied in July certain areas of northern Aleppo in the outskirts. When I went back in August, some of those areas had been secured by the Syrian army and allies. So, for example, when I went in July, I went by a road called Ramusi, which is in the south of Aleppo, to the south of Aleppo. By August, that area was so dangerous with sniping and shelling, and then later incursions from the terrorist factions and fighting between the military and the terrorists, that the only means of getting into Aleppo was the newly liberated Castello Road, which is in the north. So this is all to give some context that what is happening in Aleppo and what the media is referring to as Aleppo is what is happening is quite different from what the media is referring to. And I'll explain what most corporate media and even unfortunately some supposedly alternative independent media are referring to as Aleppo is actually eastern Aleppo. The population there is not known. Most media will say it's 200,000, 300,000. Other estimates by local sources put it at maybe 150,000, maybe far less. But the important thing to note is that in those areas of eastern Aleppo, there are terrorist factions of, as I mentioned, Jabhat al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, Nur al-Din al-Zinki, which is hopefully known to listeners as a group that beheaded a 12 or 13-year-old Palestinian child a month or so ago. Also, other factions affiliated with the Free Syrian Army, and even perhaps ISIS, it's not confirmed. So these terrorist factions inhabit the eastern quarters of Aleppo, and yet the corporate media, when they report on Aleppo, they do not report on the between 1.5 to 1.7 million civilians living in greater government-secured Aleppo. Some of the reasons they don't report on this is because if they were to honestly and fairly report on this area of Aleppo, they would have to acknowledge that terrorists that the West has been dubbing moderates, like Nur al-Din al-Zinki, which beheaded the Palestinian child, like Ahrar al-Sham, which has been firing rockets and mortars and a variety of other explosives onto the two besieged villages of Fuh and Kafaria in Idlib governorate, and other groups that the West thus far has not deemed as terrorists. If the media was to accurately report on what's happening in Aleppo to the greater population, they would have to acknowledge that these terrorists are firing I'll list them. Foreign-supplied rockets and missiles, explosive bullets, and then locally manufactured mortars and a variety of sizes of explosive gas canisters. These gas canisters are fired by hell cannons, and although if one hears the word gas canister, they might think, oh, you know, this is not an object that's going to do much damage, but like any dirty bomb, they're stuffed with shrapnel glass, and they in fact do a lot of damage. They might make a small impact on a building, but inside that building is a family, and they can kill, you know, 5 or 10 at once. And this is not based on speculation, but based on talking with doctors at the Aleppo Medical Association. So, again, if the corporate media was to report what's actually happening in Aleppo, they would have to acknowledge that from, say, September 28th until October 10th, according to state media in Syria, at least 61 civilians were killed by these mortars and bombs. And just today I was speaking with a doctor, Dr. Nabil Antaki, who is a registered doctor. He's a specialist, and he is one of 4,160 registered doctors in the Aleppo Medical Association and practicing in Aleppo. And he told me, you know, the numbers were far higher than most media have been reporting. Problem is that it's hard to keep up because literally every single day there are tens and tens. Some days, like for example in August or at the end of April, there are hundreds of these mortars and gas canister bombs and explosive bolts. Even when I was in Aleppo in July, there was an explosion about 500 meters away, which I was told was one of these gas canister bombs, and an explosive bullet landed about 10 meters away from me, but it had already exploded in the air. So it didn't hit one of the parked cars nearby, therefore didn't cause a big explosion, but could have. And the day after I left, a friend's mother was killed by one of these bullets. So just to give an example of these things are lethal, and they are raining down on civilian areas. They're hitting hospitals, they're hitting parks, and this is not reported in the corporate media because in the end, this actually shows that what the West calls moderate rebels, they're committing acts of terrorism. They are slaughtering Syrian civilians, and it's in stark contrast to the many media lies about what the media calls Aleppo, which is Eastern Aleppo. I can get into some of these lies. In fact, for example, on September 6th, I believe it was, The Guardian wrote a piece alleging that the Syrian so-called, what they say, regime, the Syrian government had used chlorine and attacked civilians in Aleppo. Now, there were many fallacies with this article. One of which being the only chlorine factory in Syria is actually controlled by terrorist factions who took it over in late 2012 or 2013 and still possess it. Another fallacy is that when you ask experts who know about the effects of chemical weapons, the photographs that different media agencies provided for this instance did not show as what an expert would say is normal chlorine reactions. On the other hand, a photo that a Syrian journalist sent to me on a different occasion did show like the blackened, charred skin, the suffocation, etc. One other major fallacy with the Guardian article on October 6th was, although the Guardian did not specify which hospital was supposedly treating these alleged victims, it did specify the area, and that was Sukkari. Now, that area, in months prior, in April, when this whole campaign, Aleppo is Burning, which is a Wall Street manufactured campaign, again designed to vilify both the Syrian government and army, when that came sprung up, at that time, we started hearing increased reports about things like the last doctor in Aleppo, again referring to Eastern Aleppo, the last pediatrician in Aleppo, the last hospital in Aleppo. And we started hearing reports about hospitals being bombed. One of the hospitals that they alleged was bombed was called the Al-Quds Hospital. Now, with that fallacy itself, allegation itself, there are many fallacies, being that, one, they said that it was targeted. It's not a registered hospital. It's actually in what looks like an apartment building. Its coordinates were never given to the Syrian army, the Russians, or even to the UN, I believe. It was set up after 2011. It's in an al-Nusra area, and while it may be treating civilians, it's primarily treating these armed thugs. And the other fallacy was that footage shows the hospital was not totally destroyed. However, if you want to go with the belief that it was destroyed in April or so, Now in September, you have the Guardian reporting that people are being treated in that hospital, though they did not specify. Other media did specify, and the Guardian did say it was Sukari district. So one can assume they mean the Al-Quds hospital, which was allegedly destroyed. Even now, if you look at reports about, in most of the corporate media, if you look at reports, you'll see contradictions within the media themselves. Some will say the last 10 doctors in Aleppo. Some will say the last 29 doctors in Aleppo. Some will say the last number of X number of hospitals. And, you know, they contradict one another. But the bottom line is, these stories are all being sourced to associations like the Aleppo Media Center, which has funding from the West, or sourced to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which has funding from the West, from Europe, or sourced to the group called White Helmets, which you mentioned earlier. And this group is absolutely not credible on many levels, and we can get into that in a little bit if you like. So just in sum, I think what critical thinking people should be doing is, if you're seeing a report that's alleging that, you know, barrel bombs have attacked a hospital, please look to some alternative sources. Because, for example, when I was in Aleppo in July, I went to visit a maternity hospital that was attacked by a terrorist rocket and destroyed. Three women were killed in that attack and many more injured, of course. And I went to visit the Al-Razi Hospital, which is a state hospital whose premises have been hit many times on the outskirts. And it was treating victims of these various terrorist attacks. And if you're going to be an honest journalist, talk to the Aleppo Medical Association, because they represent, as I said, over 4,000 doctors, and they can tell you about the many injuries that are occurring on a daily basis and the many deaths that are occurring on a daily basis. On the other hand, every time you see a report on Channel 4 News, it's affiliated with the Aleppo Media Center, and it's affiliated with a doctor who is frankly, a filmmaker who is frankly using footage that you can see is staged. You see children appearing in different videos. You see the same children. And this is not a first in the war on Syria. We've seen this with massacres in the past, and it's well known. I would hope that people realize this, that in prior wars of aggression on other states, for example, Iraq or Libya, there was immense media manipulation. So it's not far-fetched to believe that it's occurring in Syria, and indeed it's documented.
Okay, Eva, give us an understanding, since Aleppo was the business center of Syria. You talk about two different Aleppos, East Aleppo, where the terrorists have a strong hold, and that's what the Russian and Syrian forces are trying to dislodge them, get them out. But you also have main Aleppo. Tell us what life is like there, what is different in a person's ability to have any form of life, and the environment itself.
Well, that's an important question, because, so I've mentioned the daily attacks, mortars and bombs and explosive bullets, but aside from that, the main power plant, which would supply power to the over 1.5 million people there, that power plant lies outside of the control of the Syrian government, thus, in other words, in the hands of terrorists. So for years, Aleppo has not had consistent electricity. People buy electricity through ampoules, I'm not sure the terminology, but they buy it through generators. So if you're somebody who can't afford to buy electricity, you don't have electricity. Same goes with water. Terrorists control the water lines. And so, you know, over the last few years, Syrians have had to, both from the government and independent associations, have dug, I was told by an Aleppo resident, Dr. Antaki, that they have dug over 300 wells to supply water. Not all of that water is drinkable. And so then you see an increase of people getting water-related diseases because they're drinking the only thing they can find, which isn't fit for drinking. So another aspect is, I mentioned earlier the Rumusi Road to the south of Aleppo. So it's not actually the main highway to Aleppo. There's another highway, but that runs through Idlib province, which is largely controlled by terrorist factions. So for years, they have Syrian civilians and trucks have not been able to use that main highway. They've used an alternative road, which goes along, it's called the Kanasir Highway, and it goes far to the east. And then it would have gone through Rumusi and along a ring road, circling Aleppo and into the west. And Aleppo is dependent on these roads for their food, for their produce, for everything, because They used to import things, although it was an industrial district. They import a lot of food and produce from outside. So when that road's cut off, then that means people are not getting the food that they need. Another aspect, you mentioned it being an industrial city, and over the years, and this is also documented, terrorist factions, with the help of Turkey and Gulf nations, have basically stripped Aleppo. They've looted Aleppo of its factories. It could be over 2,000 now. I know a year or so ago, I read it was 1,500, and they've actually taken them. And you can see videos of them actually trucking the belongings, the machinery and equipment to the factories, towards Turkey, and boasting about it, that they're taking it to Turkey. They're returning the factories to the Gulf owners in Turkey. This is absolute nonsense. So obviously this is going to impact on the economy. To be honest, I was surprised when I was there. Life is not easy. So when I was there in July, it was during Ramadan. So people were fasting during the day, but at nighttime, people were on the streets. I was very surprised by how much life there was, in spite of the power cuts, in spite of the difficulty, in spite of the very real danger of any time there being a mortar. And I'd say that this applies throughout Syria, this pulse of life wherein people are determined not to cower at home. Their existence might be very difficult in terms of finances, because the Syrian pound, the rate to the dollar has dramatically increased, so it means that people's salaries, which used to suffice prior to 2011, don't suffice now. But that said, in spite of the hardships of their finances and the possibility of any moment being hit by a terrorist bomb or bullet, they still persist. You know, there's still life, and I was surprised by seeing so many people on the streets. And there are, there are things. Obviously, there's restaurants and cafes that run on generators, but unfortunately I wasn't able to go right to the front lines. I was about 200 meters away and not permitted to go further for my own safety, but I know people that are there, and there's a remarkable young Frenchman who's actually spending a lot of time in Aleppo, and he's meeting people. This is a really important point, and I met him just a couple of weeks ago in Beirut when he was going back to Syria. He's meeting people that fled from eastern Aleppo to the security of government secured Aleppo. And it's very interesting. He's there strictly as a humanitarian, but he's seeing these explosions. He's immersed in it. And I think the testimonies he's getting from people that had fled eastern Aleppo are really damning, because they're obviously, contrary to what the corporate media is reporting, the testimonies are saying what we know from other areas, for example, Homs or Madaya, that were held by terrorists or are currently still held by terrorists, where people complain not of the Syrian government, they complain of the terrorists. They don't want them there. The terrorists, in many instances, or most, take the food of those people, and if they sell it, they sell it at extortionist prices. So the people that this young man, Pierre, is meeting from eastern Aleppo are describing the exact same thing. I think another thing to note about Aleppo in general is that, yes, the Syrian army is making military advances, but they've opened humanitarian corridors. It was 4 last time I checked, for people from eastern Aleppo to flee and be guaranteed safety. But they are not guaranteed safety, because often when they try to flee, they are shot at by terrorist snipers. And this is, again, documented. You can see video footage of this. People who are able to actually go escape along those corridors are given medical treatment and shelter and food. And the stories they are telling are what you would expect of people that are fleeing from terrorists. I alluded to other areas, and I'll just briefly mention them. For example, Yarmouk, Madaya, or even Homs. Homs I've been to on a number of times. And in June 2014, I was in the old city of Homs, the heart of Homs, which the media dubbed the so-called capital of the revolution. Now, when I was there, the citizens that had actually remained to the very last day, when terrorists finally, in a deal, were extracted from Homs and in exchange for release of some of the terrorist prisoners and were sent to other areas, it meant safety for the people of Homs, and it meant that the fight against terrorism was brought to a different area of Syria. But those people that had stayed in old Homs, their stories were the same. The terrorists took all our food, in some instances, they killed them. They certainly were not being treated well. They certainly did not support the notion of this being a revolution. And so I would imagine that, although I haven't been to the terrorist-occupied areas of eastern Aleppo, I would imagine the situation is the same. I also have friends that have family in eastern Aleppo. So I was talking with one today. He's still in Aleppo. He has family. Of course, they don't want to speak out about publicly. They don't want to speak or use their names because of the repercussions from the terrorists, since they're still living there. In many areas, they have to pay terrorists for their safety. So if you can't afford that, then you can be punished in any number of ways. In fact, another notable thing about Aleppo is that the Syrian government has issued an offer of amnesty to Syrian, not foreign, but Syrian terrorists who are willing to lay down their weapons. So if a Syrian fighter lays down his weapons, he is given amnesty. And the idea, the premise behind this being, and this is something that people should really take note of, being that Syria doesn't want this war. They want the war to end. And Syria has, on many occasions, in many ways, offered a political solution. And they've been trying to end bloodshed. The bloodshed continues because the West continues to finance terrorists. They were funneled through Turkey and also through Israel. And they came from Iraq as well, of course. And, you know, terrorists from, I think it's well over 100 nations now, fighting in Syria, what they call a revolution. But the Syrian government has tried in many cases to offer amnesty, and people have taken it. If they can get away from the terrorists, they've come and they've laid down their weapons and they've been granted amnesty. And some of them even joined the fight with the Syrian army. And just on that note, I think it is an important one. This goes in hand with also the reconciliation movement, which for years has been the same thing. It's been offering reconciliation and amnesty to areas where terrorists, Syrian fighters, were warring against the state and the people. And there have been many successes. It's meant that people who, for whatever reason, joined what they believed to be a revolution, but at some point realized they didn't want to be a part of this anymore, it means that they have an ability to get out without repercussions. Eva, and there are many Syrians, thousands, that want this.
You're listening to Eva Bartlett. She is a independent Canadian justice activist and journalist. And she has spent a lot of time in Syria. And we're speaking to her now on Skype from Lebanon. I would like you to address many different issues, but very short answers, if you would, please.
Sure.
Regardless of the criticisms that can be aimed at President Assad, like Gaddafi in Syria, Assad has very little tolerance for Islamic extremism in jihadi organizations. And he was especially brutal in the past against the Muslim Brotherhood because all these Salafi-based groups oppose secular society. Well, we in the West, we're a secular society. We have tolerance, at least most people do, for all religions. Whatever your belief, that's your belief. As long as it's a nonviolent belief and you're not trying to take away or limit someone else's belief, you have a right to practice that. And that's what Syrian society was. It was a tolerant society. Whereas Saudi Arabia, there is no religion that is allowed except their particular Wahhabist version of Islam. And they're very intolerant. In fact, just this past year, they executed by beheading the one Shia cleric who was well known in that society. And they also give women no rights, very limited rights. And so we're in this particular understanding in America that we've been led to believe that Assad, like Gaddafi, are evil and that they must be destroyed in order to bring peace, democracy, and freedom to their countries, as the same we did with Iraq. Now, here's the issues. And please give us your perspective. Our research shows that the leading terrorist countries, Qatar and United Arab Emirates and Kuwait, but most importantly, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, they all share something in common. They all share the same desire for regime change because they all have an economic, ideological, and political reason for taking over other countries and exploiting them. So we'd like your perspective on that. And yet, if we're really against terrorism, if we're really opposed to what the terrorists are doing, why wouldn't we take issue with Saudi Arabia and other groups there that we sell weapons to that end up being used by these so-called moderates that are not moderate at all. So I'm very concerned about Americans not getting a balanced perspective here. Also, one of our leading NATO member supporters is Turkey. And we've known for a long time that Turkey has been training, arming, funding, and giving safe passage to terrorists from all over the world through Turkey into Syria and then also into Iraq, stealing Syrian oil, bringing it back into Syria, and then selling it on the black market to whoever will pay for it. And we are told that that was by Erdogan's son and family members. And if that were the case, then why didn't the Obama administration and our National Security Agency advocate bombing the truck convoys, of which there would be as many as 12,000? That can go on for, you know, like 40 miles of nothing but trucks. You can't miss that with a satellite. So we know what was being done. We didn't bomb a single truck. It took the Russians to come in and do that. And we didn't go in, we didn't put any embargo, we didn't have any conditions against either Turkey or Syria or Qatar for arming these groups. And you can't tell me, you can't tell any reasonable and educated person that there's such a thing as a moderate terrorist. You know, they're not. They have their own agendas. And you've demonized Assad, the United States has, and saying that, you know, he cannot be a part of the future. Well, if he's really a demon, surely the majority of the people of Syria would have risen up against him. And yet every study I've seen and the people who've been on the ground there that I've spoken with say the majority of Syrian people support Assad. And because what he had done prior and the quality of life in the country and the quality of education and the amount of literacy and the amount of freedom people had under Assad that they all know would never happen under any regime that came in to take its place. Now, who would take Assad's place? Well, you would have coalitions of the very people I mentioned, the countries, but then you would have their terrorist organizations running it for all intents and purposes. So you ended up with another Libya. And look at Libya. And look at Somalia. And look at Mali. And look at Iraq. And look at Afghanistan. Show me a place that offers freedom, security, and democracy for its citizens after we intervened. So would you address these concerns that we have, especially since Trump and Clinton both have a perspective on ISIS and how to deal with it, and the Assad government, and even people within the Pacifica Foundation radio have supported the invasion of Libya as well as regime change in Syria. Your thoughts, please.
Yes, thank you for all those points. They're really critical. I'll just address each one briefly. So the issue of convoys, Palmyra was occupied by Daesh specifically because the U.S.-led coalition did not stop a convoy of ISIS, Daesh's ISIS, did not stop a convoy of ISIS vehicles traversing hundreds of miles of open desert. It is not credible to believe that that with their state-of-the-art technology that the U.S.-led coalition somehow missed ISIS crossing the open desert. That's one point. Another point is just a few weeks ago, the U.S.-led coalition not only didn't attack ISIS, they actually attacked and killed 83 Syrian soldiers in the Deir ez-Zor region. Now, this was not a brief one-off attack. It was a series of attacks with four fighter planes, and it lasted for up to an hour. And even retreating Syrian soldiers were being fired at by helicopters. So this was not accidental. Now, if you look at some of the U.S. spokespersons, Samantha Power or John Kirby, none of them, no U.S. politician, let alone Obama, has apologized to the Syrian government and the families of these soldiers. Instead, they've said, we didn't do it, but if we did it, it was an accident, and we're going to investigate. This is complete nonsense. They cannot investigate their own war crime. However, it's not an accident. They actually, Syrian soldiers reported having seen drones in the area surveilling the day prior. and the U.S. did not communicate to Russia, which was part of the agreement, that they were going to do any strikes. So, and Russia actually was the one that told them, stop hitting these targets. These are Syrian soldiers. So when they attacked the soldiers, what happened right after, immediately after, in what seems almost certainly like a coordinated attack, was that ISIS took over that position. That's another point. On many instances, not only has the U.S. not attacked convoys, but they've supposedly accidentally dropped supplies to terrorists, including ISIS. What Russia has done in Syria with the invitation of the Syrian government, whereas the U.S.-led coalition does not have the invitation of the Syrian government, their presence in Syria is illegal under international law. What Russia has done has supported the Syrian military in eradicating terrorism. And because of Russia's presence and air support and other support, the Syrian army has made many gains since October of last year. The whole notion of Assad being a demon or whatever terminology you want to use, it's not surprising, because this is precisely what the West does when they want to impose a new government on a country. So we've seen it, whatever you thought of the leaders of Iraq and Libya, we've seen that they were vilified and they were caricaturized into the most gigantically evil proportion possible. However, so I've actually been to Syria five times. There must have been a mistake in my notes sent to you, but my last visit there was for 9 weeks, and it was my fifth visit, the first one being in April 2014. And in my times in Syria, I've been around Syria, so Aleppo twice, Latakia, Homs many times. Districts of Homs had been plagued by terrorism, and Maalula, Sweida, Tartus, Jeble, Nisyaf. So all these regions, I've been around, and speaking with locals, I get that there is a lot, not a lot, that's not even sufficient. There's overwhelming support for President Assad. I think it's important to note that some people have always been supporters, and others at the beginning of 2011 perhaps were among those that thought, okay, good, we want political change. I support this so-called revolution. And then believe me, I've heard many people tell me this. Eva, at the beginning, I was happy. I thought, good, we're gonna have political change, because there are certain changes that people want, but not to the extent of destroying their country, killing their own people, and even deposing President Assad. They wanted changes. They didn't necessarily want him to go. And this is what they've told me. I'm not putting words in their mouth. So many of the people that said at the beginning, we were hopeful we'd get the political change we want, now are ardent supporters of Assad, because they realize in hindsight how good they had it. Free healthcare, free education. It was one of the safest countries in the world, and many other socialist benefits. And they realize also that all these slogans for freedom and change are empty, empty slogans, because right away Assad implemented many of these changes. Perhaps not to the perfection that people want, but changes were made. And he also stood before Syrians in Damascus University in June or July 2011 saying, we need to work together. How can we change? How can we move forward? So he wasn't saying the Ba'ath Party is going to do this, I'm going to do this. He was actually imploring people to not take a violent route. And this is not, lest people think it's about Assad. It's not because he feared for his safety. It's because he genuinely doesn't want Syria to be destroyed. And I don't know the man, but I do think he's genuine in saying he doesn't want, I think he's actually pained. And this might not be easy for people to digest, but he's an intelligent man. He's highly educated. He's a doctor. And above all, he didn't ask for this war on Syria. It's not logical to think that a doctor who's in this position would want to be killing his own people. It doesn't make sense. I mean, just logically, it doesn't make sense. If you know the whole world is against you, it does not make sense that you would use chemical weapons. It does not make sense that you would attack hospitals. You would do everything you could to make your reputation look nice so the world would stop vilifying you. But the fact is, prior to 2011, the West loved him, and you can find reports saying what a great secular nation was and what a great leader, secular nation Syria was and what a great leader they had. The point is that in order to convince the public that to go in and to no-fly zone Syria, which is what certain Pacifica stations do endorse and certain leftist so-called anti-war groups do endorse, in order to get that no-fly zone, which then means bombing the heck out of Syria, which means, like we've seen with Libya, utter chaos, no freedom, no democracy, you have to first convince the public of the reasons why. So the reasons why are all these manufactured lies about bombed hospitals, about chemical weapons, and about the demonization, not lies, about the actual demonization of President Assad. Another point is that it isn't about him. It's about Syria. And he himself says it. You know, every reporter that goes and interviews him says, when are you going to step down? And he says, when the people want me to step down. And he also points out, you know, it's not about me, it's about Syria. So if it was about President Assad, then, like you said, he wouldn't have the massive support base that he does have. With regard to the no-fly zone itself, you have groups like the White Helmets, who we haven't really discussed yet in depth, but
go into depth with them because they were being put up for nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize. We have a little, unfortunately, she's in Beirut. She's in Lebanon, and there is some background noise, so please be tolerant of that. But the White Helmets in the Western media, including on Pacifica programs, have been heralded as a great humanitarian group. However, just like the chemical weapons that Seymour Hersh had to show were actually the terrorists doing the chemical weapons, not Assad's government, you have, and some other investigative journalists have uncovered a lot about the White Helmets that this audience should become educated on. Please share that with us now.
Sure, and I'm trying to mute my microphone when that noise starts up, just for your ears. The White Helmets are purported to be, they purport to be a neutral, independent rescue group comprising civilians that just want to help people out and rescue Syrians who are allegedly being massacred by this evil government. The White Helmets was, it is not independent, it is not neutral, and they are not volunteers. It was created in 2013 by the UK and the US. It's headed by a former British military officer. It's been funded over $60 million. It could even be over $100 million overtly, and who knows how much more covertly. $23 million from the U.S., the equivalent of $29 million from the U.K., $4.5 million from the Dutch government, and $7 million pledged from Germany, and plus millions more from other EU nations. So aside from the funding, the fact that it is actually very partial and it has reasons to do the bidding of Western nations that want Syria destroyed, or at least Assad deposed, the White Helmets only operate in areas where al-Nusra and other terrorists are. So eastern Aleppo, Idlib, Ghouta, which is east of Damascus. If you look at the White Helmets' photos and videos, you will find many inconsistencies. A trained medic, and I've talked with many medics and doctors who look at the videos and say, these people are not rescuers. The way they handle people that are apparently victims is not how a rescuer would handle a victim. You can take one famous example, a boy named Amran. He was alleged to be 4 or 5 years old, and his image was splashed across, you know, papers and media a month or so ago, and it showed this beautiful little boy with a little bit of blood trickling down his forehead, sitting looking stunned in an ambulance, utterly not being attended to when he was supposed to have some sort of head wound. And this is not the way a medic would. It was obviously a staged photo op. This is not, medics would not just let a kid sit there without giving them medical attention. But aside from that, you have far more incriminating evidence of the White Helmets' terrorist affiliations, in that many of them are White Helmets by day, terrorists by night, or vice versa. You can find many photos, unbelievably, many of these so-called White Helmets volunteers actually uploaded their own photos holding weapons and participating with terrorists onto their Facebook accounts and other social media. So there have been many instances documented wherein you see one who is posing as a medic, a White Helmet medic, in another photo, the very same person, and it's undeniable, is holding a weapon and posing with whatever terrorist faction, al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, Nur-ed-Din Zinki. White Helmets also have been filmed. They film themselves standing on the bodies of dead Syrian soldiers. This is not a neutral, impartial act. And you know, it's quite conceivable that given that some of these are actually terrorists themselves, that they murdered the soldiers. So there's many problems with this whole notion that white helmets are rescuers. Meanwhile, you actually do have Syrian civil defense, the real Syrian civil defense, that were established, I believe it was back in the 60s. And I met with my colleague Vanessa Bealey. We met with, she met with more in other provinces, but in Aleppo, we met with some, and they actually are volunteers. And what's notable about them is they don't have funding, they refuse funding, and at the same time, they are desperately in need of equipment that has either been stolen by terrorists in eastern Aleppo and that is being used by the white helmets, in addition to the other funded equipment, but also
they've been greatly affected
by the sanctions.
Eva, I'm going to play a clip now about what Israel is doing with the natural resources of Syria, because we hear over and over in the independent media that the United States and even Israel have been supporting some Syrian rebel groups that are in fact, Salafi terrorist organizations and very similar to ISIS. So I'm going to ask you, after you hear this clip, what you know about this, and also what information do you have to clear this question up, and what evidence is there that Israel has been supporting or aiding certain anti-Assad forces that could be labeled as terrorist groups? So please listen to this clip first.
Saudi-based Genie Energy is digging for oil in Syria, even though it clearly violates international law under the Geneva Convention. You don't have to dig too far to find out how this genie clawed out of its oil barrel. First, the reason it violates international law. Genie Oil has been granted permits to drill in Syria, not by Syria, but by Israel. That's because they're going to dig in the region of Syria known as the Golan Heights, which is occupied by the Israelis now. That occupation itself violates international law, and the drilling specifically violates the annex to the Fourth Geneva Convention. So Israel's right to dig there is hotly contested, and yet that's exactly what's happening with Genie Oil. Now for the reasons they're getting away with it. Heading up the effort is a man named Effie Aitim. He's a former Israeli military commander who has said, in an actual speech, "We cannot be with all these Arabs, and we cannot give up the land, because we have already seen what they do there. Some of them may be able to stay under certain conditions, but most of them will have to go." So this anti-Arab Israeli is heading the charge for Genie Oil to drill in Syria. He makes for a powerful force to drive the drilling forward, but his cohorts are even more powerful. Because Genie Oil investors include none other than Dick Cheney, Rupert Murdoch, Lord Jacob Rothschild, ex-CIA Director James Woolsey, ex-Secretary of the Treasury Larry Summers, ex-Governor of New Mexico Bill Richardson, and other ex-members of American government. They are all invested in Genie Oil. And they all stand to profit big time for drilling in the already ravaged Syria. So
okay.
It comes no surprise that the project is moving along.
Okay, well then tell us what you know about the larger question that I asked.
Yes. So I met with the Syrian ambassador to the United Nations, Ambassador Bashar al-Jafari, at the beginning of 2015, and interviewed him. And one of the things, obviously, that popped up was Israel's role in the war on Syria. And first, I'll mention that, you know, it has been documented that Israel is treating terrorists in their hospitals and funneling them back into Syria. Even a UK channel actually embedded with the Israeli army and made it out to be a very heroic operation of saving rebels. But anyway, it's documented. Residents of the occupied Golan see this on a daily basis. And when I met with Ambassador Jafri, he pointed out that he repeatedly has asked for, you know, action in the UN Security Council, has asked for people to take notice of the fact that, you know, Israel is treating these terrorists, Israel supporting these terrorists. He said that the United Nations Disengagement Observer Force, which has been mandated for, you know, decades in the occupied Golan to keep peace, they have observed it themselves, that Israel is dealing with al-Nusra. And this was back in 2015 when he told me this, and it continues now. And he said that they issued reports, but that the reports go nowhere. So even, you know, an element, an arm of the United Nations is documenting this Israeli dealing with and supporting of terrorists.
Okay.
But it doesn't get stopped and it doesn't get discussed.
Okay, Eva, I've got three areas. We only have 5 minutes. So if you would please, if you could give us your briefer overview on these issues. We hear in our media, and both Clinton and Trump are against Iran. What is your understanding of Iran's position in Syria? How are they supporting the government? And who do you believe would be the most likely candidate, if elected, to cause the invasion or destruction of Syria, to turn it over to the complicit organizations or monarchies in the Middle East?
I'm not an Iran expert. I know that Iran and Syria historically have a relationship. They're part of the Axis of Resistance, which has also supported Palestine. To my knowledge, Iran, I don't know the extent of their support, but I know that Iran has been a solid ally of Syria. With regards to the candidates, I'm afraid that Hillary Clinton is going to be the next president for a variety of reasons, and I'm afraid for a variety of reasons because of all people, she's got blood on her hands from Libya, as we all know, and in leaked emails recently, it's come out that she knew the West was supporting Al Qaeda in Syria and wanted that to happen, and was involved in supporting it. If she is the president, I do fear that America's exceptionalism will be the most exceptional thing we've seen yet, because, you know, we know what America is doing, and not just America, the allies are doing in Syria. We know this is against the will of the Syrian people, and it's against every international law and even UN mandates. But nonetheless, America continues to support terrorism and outright lie about what's happening in Syria, accuse Russia, when in the end it's America that's supporting terrorism and leading to the deaths of Syrian people. So if Clinton is the next president, I am very worried that this will escalate. On the other hand, Russia has made it clear they're not going to stand for serious U.S. interference. So if the U.S. does try to impose a no-fly zone, Russia's military presence has increased in Syria, particularly given the number of times the U.S. Proxy moderate terrorists have attacked Russian troops and airplanes. So, I mean, it's going to escalate. For the sake of the Syrian people, I pray that, you know, the Western public stops believing these lies and doesn't support the West in their venture to impose a no-fly zone, because by every indication shows that this is what they want to do.
Eva, again, have you been made aware that the Chinese are considering sending troops into Syria to support the Russian and Syrian armies war against the terrorist organizations?
I don't know that personally. Okay. I think I've seen reports a couple of weeks ago. As you mentioned, I'm in Lebanon. I don't have the best Wi-Fi. However, it is in China's interest as well to ally with Russia and Syria, because in the end, this isn't just about Syria. It is also about, you know, financial, about currency wars. It's about Russia and China as well. Okay. So if China does support Syria on the ground, then I wouldn't be surprised, and I'm sure Syria would welcome it. And just say also, Syrian people welcome Russia's intervention. It's not just the Syrian government. The people I met there were very happy that Russia was there, adding to the fight against terrorism.
My last question, and we have about two and a half minutes. From all of your conversations with all the different people in all the different areas, at all different levels of society, explain to us what they see as the reasons why the United States, Turkey, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, why do they all want to see Assad and the entire Syrian government gone? What is their real goal? What is the reward they're looking for?
I'll just say this as well. The Syrians are very intelligent and educated people, and they are aware, the majority are aware of this plot against Syria. Obviously, gas resources are a main thing, the pipelines that would go through Syria, the pipelines, you know, the Israeli, Qatari, European allied pipelines that would cut right through Syria versus a pipeline that would be supported by Russia and Iran. So resources are one issue. You know that Israel is stealing Palestinian gas as well, and they want to drill in the Golan. So resources is one. Resistance is another. Syria, Iran, formerly Libya was very affiliated, and Hezbollah in Lebanon are all a strong resistance axis, and they have all supported Palestinians in their just struggle against the Zionist movement and the Zionist occupation of Palestinian land. So that's another aspect, is breaking apart this very strong secular resistance nation. And we know that America for decades has had a plan. Google Ralph Peters' Blood Borders, and you'll find an article talking about, and he's not the only one, talking about how the West has years and years ago had a plan to cut up the countries of the Middle East, to make them manageable little fiefdoms, install puppet governments, wherein then there is no threat to American hegemony, and the Americans in the West, the Western interest, have their access to resources. So, bottom line, it's not about human rights. They don't give a darn about human rights. They don't care about civilians in Syria. That's what people need to remember. When you hear these claims, remember this bottom line. The West doesn't care about the lives of Syrian people, so don't believe them when they cry crocodile tears and ask for a no-fly zone. They want Syria cut up. They want a president that will give them the resources and that will do what they say. Remember, Saudi Arabia, as you mentioned, is one of the most vile nations, and it is massacring Yemeni civilians, and it has been to the deafening silence of the UN and of Western media. And this is the being that is heading the United Nations Human Rights Council, and this is the being that can talk about democracy. So the lies and absurdities regarding Syria are so great. I would just urge people to turn off your corporate media, because you will not find any truth about Syria there, and certain alternative Pacifica stations as well. I'm sad to say, to this day, support a narrative which is falsely, patently false about Syria.
We are aware of that. Eva Bartlett, thank you for being with us today. Eva Bartlett is in Lebanon. Sorry for some of the background noise, but she was calling from a place where she didn't have complete privacy. And Eva's writings. Eva, give us your website one more time, please.
Yes, at the moment it's ingaza.wordpress.com, and I hope to change that in the future to one after my own name, but ingaza.wordpress.com, and you can find a section, Syria, which has my published articles. Also interesting for people, videos and audio from Syria. You can get a taste of what Syrians are saying themselves.
Eva Bartlett from Lebanon, thank you for being with us. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know